last week, for those of you who were, maybe for those of you who weren't able to make it out to the baptism service, last week was this wonderful time for us as a church to really watch what we talked about. Our message last week, and it just kind of fit in with this idea of the mission statement of the Alliance, was about how we as a people of God, as the church, are to be people who proclaim Christ. And so it was this great celebration as we literally watched people proclaiming Christ with their words and their testimonies, and then to follow him in obedience into baptism. And there were two things that I asked you to think about as we left last week. And I know there was, you know, a celebration and a big party and lots of things like that afterwards. But there's still good questions and good things to think about. So I would encourage you to keep thinking about what's one way in your life that you can be faithful in proclaiming the name of Christ. What's one way in your life that you can be demonstrating Christ to the people that you interact with in the world all around you all the time. People who are in church, people who are outside of church, people who are family or friends or neighbors. How can we be people as individuals who are faithful in proclaiming the name of Jesus? And then as a church, how can we be people who faithfully proclaim the name of Christ? What are some of the things that we should be doing that help us to do that? How does that shape the way that our worship and our messages and our service opportunities and in our children's ministries and youth ministries look? What's it look like for us as a church to proclaim the name of Christ together? So I'd encourage you to keep wrestling and thinking and asking God to help give you guidance in that sort of way. And you recall, we talked a little bit about this idea of sort of show and tell in that regard. And one of the passages that I like as we think about proclaiming the name of Christ is that imagery in Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. And in that passage, which is a familiar one to many of us, it says, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden." And those are the words of Jesus. And for people who are more familiar with, you know, the New King James or the King James Version, this is that famous city on a hill passage. So it's literally, you know, Jesus kind of says, as the church, that we are a people who are kind of this city up on a hill, something that's easily seen to the world around it. And it goes on in that passage and follows it up by saying that light is supposed to be broadcast to the world around. It uses that imagery of, you know, you don't light a lamp, you don't light an oil lamp and put it underneath a bowl. That's dumb. You know, we don't turn our lights on in our house when it's dark and throw heavy blankets over top of them. That's a silly thing. It's counterproductive. And Jesus says in the same way, as the church, as his followers, we're supposed to be kind of set up on this hill, easily seen to the world around us, for who we are. And that is the light and the hope of a world that's dark and hopeless lots of times. That's what the Christian church is supposed to be. And so as we think about that idea, that kind of carries with it this notion of sort of show and tell, like we talked about. You know, when you're up on the hill, when it's easily seen, then what you're doing is showing people who you are. And the message you're giving is proclaiming to people who you are. There's not supposed to be any kind of ambiguity, any uncertainty, any unclarity over who we are as Christians. People should know that we're Christians because through our actions and through our words, we're consistently proclaiming the name of Christ together. And so as we move on this morning, we're going to be talking about how not only do we love together, not only do we proclaim together, but we also need to be a people who are reaching together. That third line in the CMA mission statement is, "Together we will reach." And I'll be the first to admit, when I first read that, I thought, so we're talking about proclaiming and we're talking about reaching. It seems like a little bit redundant. It seems like a very similar kind of idea. Obviously, if you're putting the word out there, if you're seeking to share that with lots of people, then the hope, the intent on the back end of that is that you would be reaching people with that message. But as I looked into this a little bit more, there are some clear differences that come up when we think about what it means for us as a church to be people who are committed to reaching others with the good news of Jesus. And so as we look at that this morning, we're going to look at a passage specifically and focus in on a passage and kind of the story that takes place in Acts chapter 17. And as we prepare to look at that passage, there's a video that we're going to play. And this video, it really It doesn't go through and illustrate where different events are happening in the book of Acts. It more references them through the time, through the history of it, and not necessarily pairing it with the book. But this video kind of walks us up through the book of Acts to the point where we're where our story takes place today. So we'll watch it now.
In Jerusalem, AD 30, Jesus died on the cross, resurrected on the third day, and then ascended into heaven. 50 days after Jesus' resurrection, the Holy Spirit fell on the apostles, giving them power, purpose, and a plan. Out of joy, the church was born. Empowered by the Spirit, Peter gave his first sermon, and 3,000 hearts were transformed. Hearing, receiving, and repenting, the young church walked in unity and garnered praise. Out of joy, the gospel creates community. Peter and John then continued to spread the gospel through preaching and miracles, and the church grew by 5,000. In AD 31, Stephen gave a powerful sermon, and the enraged crowd stoned him, making him the first Christian martyr. Around AD 34, on the road to Damascus, the Lord transformed the heart of Saul, a man who persecuted countless Christians, and Saul became Paul. After this conversion, the gospel continued to spread through the ministries of Paul and Peter. God gave Peter a vision and used him to first reach the Gentiles. In AD 44, King Herod Agrippa I executed the Apostle James and had Peter arrested, but an angel rescued Peter, leading him out of the prison. As the believers were scattered because of persecution, the center of operations for Christianity then turned from Jerusalem to Antioch, where Paul and Barnabas were sent out on their first missionary journey. In AD 49, an argument arose over whether it was necessary for Gentiles to follow Jewish traditions and customs, particularly circumcision. But the Jerusalem Council sent a letter to the Gentiles, affirming that circumcision was not a requirement for salvation. Meanwhile, in their missionary journeys, Paul and Barnabas disagreed over John Mark traveling with them, and they separated. Barnabas and John Mark then sailed to Cyprus, while Timothy joined Paul as they spread the gospel throughout Asia Minor and Greece. We must keep reminding ourselves of the gospel so that we are careful not to drift toward false gospels. A church consumed with itself will move away from the truth and move toward irrelevance. Salvation comes only through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Not traditions, not customs, not good works. This is the message that must move forward, because the mission doesn't stop. Out of joy, the church multiplies.
So in our passage, in Acts chapter 17, what's taking place, like it's sort of outlined there, leading up to this, Paul is on his second missionary journey. And as Paul goes out, there's kind of an interesting setup that takes place that leads into this journey. And so we're not going to read from Acts chapter 15, but if you go back and you read through there, what you see that takes place is that Paul and Barnabas had been out on a journey together. And they go out and they have this effective missionary trip, and then they're back and they're kind of settling this dispute over whether all of the people need to live under the Jewish law or not when they're proclaiming Christ. And this whole kind of conversation happens, and then they get ready to go out on their second missionary journey. And when that happens, this disagreement arises between the two of them and it's over Mark. And apparently Paul does not want anything to do with Mark. Mark abandoned them on an earlier trip, and so he says, I don't want him to come with us. Barnabas is saying, come on, kind of give the young guy a second chance, it's more advocating for him. And so we see this kind of build up before the second missionary trip of Paul. And there are a few things that I think are important for us to see as we look at this. And the first is this, that the apostles are far from perfect people. They are not perfect people. And lots of times when we look at Scripture, we think that The characters in the Bible are kind of perfect, or they're good. You know, they're good in a way that is something that's unattainable for us, or they're special in a way, and we're used by God in a way that's impossible for us to be used. But when we look at Scripture, it's kind of an interesting thing that Luke decides to include this fight that takes place between Paul and Barnabas, because what we see is some very clear sort of imperfections that come out in Paul. You know, he's this guy that we look at and we say, well, he wrote, you know, a big chunk of the New Testament. He made this huge impact for the kingdom. And yet he seems a little bit, he's kind of hard line. He seems maybe a little bit like he holds a grudge. He seems maybe a little bit kind of fickle in this. He's like the bad cop in the story, where he's saying, you know, he didn't prove himself before. There's no reason for us to take him along with us. And Barnabas sort of plays this nicer end of things. But Luke doesn't have to write in that controversy at all. You know, he could have easily said that Paul and Barnabas went their separate ways, and Paul and Silas went to do one thing, and Barnabas and Mark went to do another thing, but he doesn't say that. He includes sort of the argument in there, and so we see this imperfection, and we also see their personalities. You know, we understand kind of that these are real people who are seeking to serve God. And so when we think of Barnabas, you know, lots of times we think of the meaning of his name. Lots of us know and have heard that the name Barnabas means the son of encouragement. And so it makes sense that he's like the nice guy in this story. He's saying, okay, Mark messed up in the past. We just need to give him another chance. We just need to kind of allow him to kind of prove himself to us. We need to sort of bring this young guy along with us. And what we know is that Barnabas's real name isn't Barnabas when we read in Acts chapter 4. It says that his name is Joseph. But he's such an encourager that he gets this nickname that is the son of encouragement. So on one hand, you have this nice guy, Barnabas. And on the other hand, we have Paul. And if we think of Paul, and it referenced him in the video, if we think of him before he became a Christian, I mean, he is a zealot. He's a guy who he was a Jew of Jews. He was a teacher of the law. He was someone who, you know, it talks about how upright he was in accordance with the law and how forceful he was in making other people follow that law. It says in the stoning of Stephen, which it referenced, it didn't say it in the video, but when you read through that account, where Stephen is stoned, it says that people then go to Saul and they lay their cloaks at his feet, kind of like as he was giving permission to this event that took place. So Paul is this kind of this tough older guy, and Barnabas is this younger guy. But what we see in there is that these people who are going out and reaching the world for Christ, they are real people. They are normal people with faults and personalities and quirks that affected the way that they did their ministry. And so they go on with that. And so Paul doesn't budge. And so him and Silas, they take off on this missionary journey. And they start going through Asia Minor and they head to Greece. And what takes place is what normally took place in these missionary journeys. And that was that some people heard about the new life that was offered in Christ. And they placed their faith in him and they experienced that and they repented. And a lot of people, or a vocal group of people, opposed the message that Paul brought to them. And they opposed it to such an extent that there were moments where he's kind of fleeing for his life. And so where our story picks up today, Paul is kind of on the run. He's had to leave the rest of his group behind as kind of the spokesperson. They're kind of hiding out, figuring out how they're going to meet up with him. And he goes into the city of Athens. And you might expect that when he walks into the city of Athens, he has a very different experience. When he goes into Athens, he comes into a city that is very religious and that recognizes a multitude of different religions. And so on one hand, you might expect Paul to kind of breathe a sigh of relief where he thinks, I can kind of fit in here and I'm not going to cause any problems and people aren't going to try to kill me or run me out or anything like that. But that's not what we read happens. It says that when Paul walks in, he is greatly distressed by what he sees around him. And so when we think about the layout of the city of Athens, like lots of cities in antiquity, it's kind of this image of a city that's literally on a hill, for reasons of fortification, for reasons of kind of security. He walks into the city on a hill, but when he walks in, it's a city that is filled with temples to the different Greek gods and to gods from around the world. You know, there are synagogues, there are all kinds of things. But he walks in and is greatly distressed at what he sees. You know, when he goes through the gates, he can literally see the huge temples that were built. He would see a temple to Demeter. He would see all of these statues to goddesses and gods like Poseidon and Athena and Zeus and Apollo and Hermes. He would see this kind of this sanctuary, the statues of Dionysus. And when he looks up on the Acropolis, he would see this kind of massive, we talk about the Parthenon, this massive temple to the goddess Athena. And so it says he walks into this scene and he just kind of feels distressed. If we can imagine that feeling of walking into a place that is very religious and at the same time is very sort of opposed to what our lifestyle represents, that's what Paul walks into when he goes into the city of Athens. And he begins doing what he does in lots of places, sharing the gospel. And so it says he starts by going to the synagogues. And that's sort of the more natural. It says that he reaches out to Jews and to God-fearing non-Jews, and he begins to share the message saying, hey, you already believe in God. You already understand who Jehovah is. You're already looking for the Messiah. And I don't know if you've heard, but I'm here to tell you that the Messiah came in the person of Jesus, and you have new life. And so he proclaims that message. And that's sort of the safe place for him to proclaim the message. But then he doesn't just stay and proclaim the message in the comfortable synagogues. It says that he goes out into the marketplace and he starts talking. He goes out into the marketplace and he starts talking with the philosophers of the day. And he starts sharing with them this gospel message. And when they hear it, they think that Paul is crazy. There's language in there in Acts 17 where it says they call him a babbler, and that's kind of a poor translation, but it's sort of this hard imagery. But in the Greek, they call him sort of a bird that's picking up seed and dropping it. And what it meant was they were saying that he was kind of a phony intellectual. He's talking with all of these sort of kind of philosophers that think very highly of how smart they are and think very highly of the ways they think about life. And they say, you're not really an intellectual. You're not really a philosopher. You're just taking some other teacher's message and you're sharing that. And really, they were right. That's exactly what Paul was doing in sharing the message of Christ. But so to them, he kind of first comes across as sort of this phony, this fake. And it says he's talking with two different groups of intellectuals, two different kind of schools of philosophy. And they're important for us to know what they are in the story. One is that he talks to this group called Epicureans. And so Epicureanism is kind of, it's really this form of hedonism. So it's a way that you pursue a life of pleasure. It means that the sort of the end goal of all of life is that you're comfortable, you're happy, and that it's through your comfort that you find meaning. And lots of us wouldn't say this, but this is the way that the vast majority of people live today. You know, that we do things that we think will improve our lives. And so Epicureanism is kind of a strain of hedonism. So they didn't just, you know, it wasn't like they ate until they were sick. They drank until they were sick. You know, they just pursued and drank in all of the pleasure like a pure form of hedonism. But they said the way that we find pleasure as people is that we live in a self-controlled manner. We work hard and we find contentment in the material world around us. And that was sort of the end, the chief end of a person's life. And there's sort of this this slogan that's been used on Epicureans' tombstones and still used in some kind of humanist traditions today, where they would say, I was not, I was, I am not, I do not care. That's kind of the message of life. You try to make the most of it while you're here. And there's an element where you would say these people are really good moral people. You know, they believed in hard work. They believed in living a simple, modest life. They believed in pursuing good things about life. But they had no recognition of the gods or really of an afterlife. They said kind of that they sort of allowed for a belief in the gods, but said they're material creatures just like the rest of us. They're far off doing their own thing. They're not concerned with human affairs. And that when we die, that's it. And the story is over. And so that's one of the groups that Paul's talking to. And there are a lot of people that kind of fall into this sort of a lifestyle today. You know, where we're so concerned on thinking this is it and making ourselves happy now, that even if, you know, we have things like a good work ethic, we believe in living modestly, you know, we live an upright kind of moral life, we don't always recognize what's beyond this life. So that's one of the groups he's talking to. The other group, the other kind of school of thought and philosophy were the Stoics. And when we think of a Stoic, we're pretty much right on. When you think of someone who has a Stoic expression, they're almost cold, they're reserved, they're non-emotional in any way. They don't get too hot, they don't get too cold, or they don't get too low, you know. They're just kind of a very even-keeled sort of person. And the reason why we describe someone like that as Stoic is because this whole school of thought believed that knowledge was the key to life. And not just knowledge in a general sense, but a specific universal law that they called the Logos. And so they thought that one of the key things that disrupted people and stopped people from understanding and experiencing that knowledge is emotion. At all costs, you kind of tried to live a life that avoided these negative emotions that took you away from the Logos, which is kind of the perfect nature of humanity. And so Paul talks to this group. And again, there are some elements where, you know, it would be easy in some senses for Paul to say to them, you know, you talk about the Logos, which means literally the word. You know, you talk about this way of life that you're supposed to live. And we acknowledge the word and the word that became flesh in Jesus. And so there are these clear differences that take place. But Paul is kind of confronted with these two different schools of thought that we see all the time in our world today. That human achievement is kind of the crowning element for us as a human being. That human achievement and knowledge, the attainment of knowledge, is the end of life. That comfort is the end of life. You know, he's talking with people that live in ways that we can understand and relate to very well. And as he talks with them, it babbles on to them, as they say. Eventually, he's invited to come to a court and to speak with them in a more formal manner. And when he goes, he begins to present the gospel. And in Acts chapter 17, verses 22 to 23, it says this. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I am going to proclaim to you." And so in that sense, when Paul talks to them, he says, "Hey, I understand what you're doing, but I understand really what's going on here." And he finds maybe what would be this more obscure temple to an unknown God. And there's lots of different things that have been written about that. But he uses that as his foothold to explain the gospel. And it goes on beginning in verse 24 and says, "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands." That's something that's easy for us to acknowledge. That's something that even in lots of our, not all, but lots of religions that we see practiced today that don't kind of follow a temple worship model, that we can kind of relate to easily. But what he says goes against everything in their culture and their fabric of their religious belief in saying that God doesn't reside in temples. He goes on to say, "And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything." Again, these people live their lives trying to serve the gods to appease them. "Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." And so in doing this, Paul clearly proclaims the message of who God is. And he goes on, this isn't the full message, but he goes on and he explains who Jesus is to these philosophers and to these leaders of a society that has beliefs that are very different than what he knows and than what we can really even imagine today. And in doing so, he reaches out to this people. You know, Paul demonstrates the importance of what it looks like for us to approach a group of people that are very different than us and to boldly proclaim the name of Christ in an effort to reach them. He doesn't just sit back like a city on a hill and wait for them. Not that that's a bad thing. That's a good thing to be a city on the hill. It's one of the ways we're instructed to live. But he doesn't just wait for that people to come to him. He doesn't just sit in the synagogues where it's comfortable. He goes out and he approaches the people and he tells them about Jesus. And so in this, we see a few important things about what it means for us to reach out together. And the first is this, that Paul intentionally took the gospel message to the people. Like we just said, Paul isn't content to just wait for people to come and ask him questions. Paul isn't just content to wait for people to come into a Christian gathering and then to kind of hear about the message. You know, lots of us would love for people to hear the message of the gospel. Lots of us would love for people to experience the new life. Lots of us are very, you know, have a great relationship with Christ, are committed to living a life that pleases him. We seek him out in prayer. We read scripture. We're involved in serving others. We're involved in church life. But one of the hardest things for us as Christians so often is for us to reach out and share that news with others. And Paul, he isn't content to just sit back. He goes out and he shares the message of the gospel with other people. And then the second thing is this, that Paul didn't do this unknowingly. You know, what we see in the story is that he observed and he learned about the people that he was sharing the gospel with. Because one of the other kind of gut reactions and responses that we oftentimes have as Christians is to kind of write people off immediately. It's to kind of just focus in on our own sort of culture, our own bubble, our own sphere of comfort, and to not really get to know people who are outside of that, and to not really seek to understand the world or people's thoughts outside of that, but to just kind of live in sort of a protected area. And Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't offer us that example. It says, yeah, he was distressed when he walked into Athens and he saw the temples and the statues and the way that people worship. But he didn't withdraw and remove himself. He learned about the culture. And one of the things I think that blows my mind kind of about this is that the Greeks, while they worshiped all of these gods, they weren't just kind of passive. They weren't just satisfied oftentimes with allowing other people to sort of have their own thoughts and their own religion. You know, when they talk about the Hellenization, kind of the spread of Greek thought and philosophy and religion throughout the world that they were in control of, it was a sort of oftentimes a violent kind of oppression that people experienced. And so Paul would have understood what it was like when the Greeks came to Jerusalem. When you read back in the stories of kind of the period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, it talks about this figure, Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled over, this Greek ruler over the area in Israel. And it says he came into the temple, he slaughtered pigs on the altars, he outlawed the practices of the Sabbath and made them punishable by death. He did all of these things to try to forcefully transform people to believe in the way that the Greeks believe, to follow the Greek gods. And so Paul knows that history. It would have been not too far in the past. And yet he walks in and where lots of people would be tempted to just write them off as heretics and bad people and ignore them, Paul takes the time to learn about them and to get to know them. And then also Paul reached out in a manner, even knowing what he knew, that maintained respect for others, that acknowledged the worth that others had. You know, you kind of see that season all throughout the verses in this message. You know, I understand you have this unknown God. I'm going to proclaim that to you. I understand that you're religious people in every way. So I understand a little bit about you. It's a way that is kind of confident and firm, but it's not, it doesn't come across as this sort of judgmental, condemning kind of language by Paul, because he knows he doesn't have to be defensive when he approaches these people. He understands and believes that he has the message of truth that he is sharing for them. And so Paul reached out in a manner that was respectful for others. And finally, and I've switched these up on you, Shannon, I'm sorry for that. But Paul was burdened to share the good news with people. You know, he walked in and it was a situation where he felt sick and felt like he needed, felt compelled to share the good news with the people who were around him. And that is something that we need if we're going to be faithful in reaching out to others. We have to care about the people that we're trying to reach. We have to really understand and look at the situation and see that there's a message of hope and new life that as a church, we have the responsibility of sharing with the world around us. And so this morning, I want us again to kind of think through two questions. I want to ask you as an individual, who is a person in your life that you have the ability to reach with this good news? And I don't want us to just brush over that and forget about it when we go to lunch today, but I want us to really think about that right now. Who is one person that you interact with, a friend, a family member, a neighbor, a coworker that you have a good relationship with? Who's one person that you talk with that you think, I know that they need to experience the new life that's offered in Jesus, and how can you be a part of reaching them with that news? How can you be burdened to share that news with them? And then the second question is this, that how can we as a church be a people that reach others for the gospel? Who does our church need to reach? How can we reach people as a church? How can we be faithful in the mission that God has given us to be people that proclaim and reach others with the good news of Jesus Christ, with the new life that's offered in Jesus Christ? And there are three, to go back to our kind of mission statement, there are three questions that are asked under this point that we need to be people that reach together that I think are good for us to think about. It says the world's population is shifting and nations are literally coming to our neighborhoods. Is our church fully participating in this unprecedented opportunity to share the gospel? Has our church been guilty of seeing children, the disabled, the senior adult, or anyone as less important than everyone else? You know, these are hard questions for us to think about. And then the last one he asks is more kind of less in a neighborhood sort of sense and more on a global sense. But the president asks, as 4,075 peoples, and he means people groups, languages of people, are still to be reached, have we joined the Alliance family in taking seriously our assignment to participate in bringing the gospel to them? And so this morning, I would ask you to really spend some time thinking about these two things. On a personal level, who can I reach? And for us as a church, who can we reach? How can we be faithful in this call that God's given us? And how can we do that in a way that's similar to Paul? It's something that's burdened in our hearts. It's something that we desire to do. It's something that we do because we care about other people. Those are important questions for us as a church to navigate. And so I'd ask you to think about them, and not just to sort of think about it and let it go, but when you come up with ideas, when things pop into your mind, let me know. Let anyone on the leadership team know. I'll tell you that this kind of question, who does our church need to reach, is something that has been sort of burning in our minds for months of meetings. That as we've been talking about the ways that as a church we can reach out to our community and be focused on seeing people come to know Christ. So I'd really ask for your input on that. And we're going to close with a time of prayer. And as we do that, we're going to have just a moment of silence. And in that time, I'd ask you to pray that God would show you that person that he's put in your life already that you can reach. And then I'll close us in prayer.